This is an ABC podcast.
Hello, I'm James Carlton. Welcome to God Forbid, our second episode in which I'm sharing the presenter's microphone with researcher and human rights advocate, Dr. Breanne Fallon. Welcome back, Bree.
Hello again, James. It was wonderful to speak together last week about the right to vote, and this week we have another ethics-themed topic about human rights.
Indeed we do. Human rights, legal rights, rights we think we have and rights we think we have but don't have. Isn't that right?
Yeah, we're going to be speaking about the latter today because, unlike most similar liberal democracies, Australia actually does not have a Bill of Rights. Instead, our human rights protections can be found in other places, but not in sort of one overarching document. And while it might seem or feel or sound like we have a workable system, the question of whether or not we actually need a Bill of Rights is still a good one to ask.
Well, a good person to ask, surely, is Sarah Joseph. She's Professor of Human Rights Law at Griffith University. For 15 years, she was the director of the Castan Centre for Human Rights Law. She's taught human rights courses around the world. She's conducted human rights training programs in Vietnam, Indonesia, Myanmar, and in Australia. Sarah Joseph, welcome to God Forbid.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
You have published, you've researched, you teach, you advise about Australian human rights law. Why is this area appealing to you? You could have been a high-paid corporate lawyer.
Okay. Well, I suppose I've always had a strong interest in social justice. And so learning and teaching about human rights and doing research on human rights has ended up being very appealing to me and a great job for me myself.
Well, Australia is already one of the freest countries on earth. Culturally, as well as politically, legally, we respect human rights relative to most other countries. So are there pressing human rights issues facing Australia today?
Oh, I think there are pressing human rights issues which face every country, and certainly in Australia. Some of the most high-profile ones concern the treatment of refugees, the treatment of Indigenous people, the treatment of people with a disability. I think whilst it might be right that Australia does have a comparatively free society, I think it would be very wrong to assume that we have no human rights issues.
Well, Sarah, I'm very much looking forward to picking your brain on the topic. But we have quite the panel today because we are also joined on God Forbid by Professor George Williams AO. George Williams is the Deputy Vice Chancellor, Planning and Assurance, Anthony Mason Professor and Professor at UNSW. He has served as Dean of UNSW Law. He has written and edited 37 books, including Human Rights Under the Australian Constitution. As chair of the Victorian Human Rights Consultation Committee in 2005, he helped bring about Australia's first state Bill of Rights, the Victorian Charter of Human Rights and Responsibilities. George Williams, welcome to God Forbid.
Thank you.
Forgive me for asking a personal question right off the bat, but human rights is a difficult space to work in. What keeps you working in this field?
I think I'm motivated by the fact that our system often doesn't work very well for some people. I think a sense of injustice is often what drives me, in the sense that we need to do better as a community. The fact that our Aboriginal peoples, for example, denied the vote for so many decades is something that horrifies me and says that there was room for change then and there's much more room for change now.
Okay, we heard you help Victoria with its Charter of Rights and Responsibilities. How does that fit into the suite of protections we enjoy in this country?
Well, Australians like to think we have a really comprehensive suite of protections, and they often think to the United States in that respect. And, of course, the US famously has a Bill of Rights. It has a system that people recognise from popular culture, and they make assumptions about what we have as a result. But, in fact, we have nothing like that, let alone what the United Kingdom, Canada, New Zealand or other countries have. We don't have a national Bill of Rights. What we do have are scattered instruments. We've got a Human Rights Act in Victoria, the ACT in Queensland. Those are important, but it's a bit like an incomplete jigsaw puzzle, and it means that the bottom line for many people is that they may be vulnerable, they may have their human rights breached, but there's no remedy, there's no comeback, because they may be unlucky enough to live in one of the many jurisdictions where there's no protection.
But there have been many attempts by legislatures to codify a human rights document. Why have they not succeeded at the federal level?
Yeah, there have been many attempts. You can go back to the 40s, the 80s. The Rudd government also had a process. And I think the bottom line is there's nothing that different really about Australia, say, to the United Kingdom, which got theirs in 1998, Canada, New Zealand and the like. The reason we haven't, I think, largely comes down to political failings. It's a bit like our referendum record, that often these things have been mismanaged. Perhaps the wrong model was put forward. Perhaps it wasn't argued for strongly enough, or perhaps it was just bad luck. So in the 80s, there just wasn't the majority in the Senate to get it through at the right time. So it's a mix of these political factors, not a want of trying, that has made us unique in the democratic world in not actually having enacted a national instrument of this kind.
So, Sarah, I'm wondering, what purpose would a Bill of Rights actually serve us?
Well, it depends on the type of Bill of Rights that you're talking about. I mean, the strongest Bill of Rights which could possibly happen would be a full Bill of Rights inserted into the Constitution, which, to be frank, I don't see happening for quite a long time because it would require a referendum process, and it doesn't look like there's an appetite for that amongst either of the major parties. You could have the Gareth Evans style, which was to introduce Commonwealth legislation, which would apply across Australia and would apply so as to bind the states. And or you could have a what was recommended by the Brennan Inquiry under the Rudd government, which is much more like the state-based documents in Victoria and Queensland. I think the latter document is possibly the weakest type of document, but it would still provide people, as George said, with with the chance of a remedy in the case of their human rights being breached. There are just too many occasions in the country at the moment where there just is no remedy. It would also, it would make Australia and Australians much more conscious of their human rights. So I think we are lagging behind other countries in having a human rights culture. Now, that's not saying that we all run around not caring about other people's rights, but I think we are significantly less aware of rights issues in this country. And one thing that can catalyse that is, in fact, a Bill of Rights.
But forgive me for being ignorant. Haven't we signed on to a lot of international conventions, the ICCPR, for example? If we're signed on to those, why would we need a federal Bill of Rights?
Well, we are signed on to most of the UN core human rights treaties, but international law does not automatically become part of Australian law. The ICCPR is certainly binding on Australia in international law, but it's not part of domestic law to the point where, say, I can walk into an Australian court and base my claim simply on the basis that there has been a breach of the ICCPR. So the fact that we have undertaken international obligations does not directly change our domestic law. And we don't have a particularly good record of incorporating our international obligations into our domestic law. We've done that with the Convention on Racial Discrimination. We've done that on the Convention on Elimination of Discrimination Against Women. But we haven't done it with the two covenants. You've already mentioned the ICCPR, the other one being the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. So there are a significant number of international obligations that have not yet become part of our domestic law, enforceable in local Australian courts.
So what's the point of signing up to these UN treaties if they're unenforceable?
Government one day can choose to incorporate them into our law, and we have already done that with the two anti-discrimination treaties. We also do that to show a good face at the international level. The Australian government does genuinely believe that a lot of the ICCPR rights are protected, are kind of scattered around in random laws, such as, for example, laws which control the police, which are not written in human rights language. And so there is this kind of mesh, a mesh of laws across Australia. But because it's a mesh, I think that there's a lot of gaps where human rights abuses, in fact, fall through the gaps. And then there's probably even less with regard to the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights. We do have a lot of rights with regard to, say, you know, welfare rights, but welfare rights get watered down and changed all the time. And so I'd say the International Covenant on Economic, Social and Cultural Rights, of all of the treaties, has probably had the least impact on Australian law.
So, George, we're hearing from Sarah that we have a mesh, a patchwork of rights, that they're scattered everywhere. Are there any rights in our Constitution? And if so, what are they?
Look, there are some rights in the Australian Constitution. For example, there's a right that says you can't be discriminated against based upon your state residence. So if you live in Tasmania, you can't be denied a job in Victoria because you're from Tasmania. There's also a right to the exercise of religion, which is something that sounds like a strong right, but in fact has never been successfully invoked. The High Court has also managed to discover some rights by reading between the lines, if you like, by implication into the text of the Constitution. And what it's done there is it's actually said, because we're a democracy, because the people have a right to freely choose their representatives, then that implies some level of free speech about political matters. So there are a number of protections that have been recognised in the Constitution, but what we don't have are rights, say, more broadly about freedom of speech. Artistic freedom, for example, is not covered. Rights to equality can't be found in the Constitution. It's a very long list of broader rights that just simply don't have any purchase in the document. And that reflects the fact it wasn't drafted to have a Bill of Rights, and it was drafted in a very different era when, in fact, it was just not a thought to be a normal thing to put these in constitutional instruments.
But, Sarah Joseph, Australia also has English common law, or we are, you know, descended from that system. That is a powerful tool for the protection of rights, and one that evolves to meet changing societal needs, unlike a fixed Bill of Rights. Isn't that the case?
Yeah, I'm afraid I don't agree with that. I think the common law is reasonably good at providing a bit of protection for some basic, largely civil and political rights. The common law provides very little protection at all for economic, social and cultural rights, can very easily be overridden by statute, and historically has not always been a great friend of human rights. And so I don't really buy the argument that the wonderful common law system has been a great protector of rights. It might be flexible, and that's, you know, it's certainly true that the common law can evolve. I mean, flexibility can also be built into statutes. I mean, one criticism of the Bill of Rights, and this is a criticism often made by, for example, former Premier of New South Wales, Bob Carr, who's very prominent on this issue, is people kind of point at the US Bill of Rights and say that, look, that's not necessarily appropriate for our time, and the one thing they'll point out in particular is the right to bear arms. And I would agree, the right to bear arms is not actually appropriate in the 21st century, something that was written in the 18th century. But the US Bill of Rights is a very old Bill of Rights. It is written in much more absolutist language. If you look at the language of treaties, modern constitutional or statutory bills of rights, they do allow for some limits. They allow for proportionate limitations to protect other legitimate ends. And so there is some level of flexibility whereby even rights enshrined in statute can adjust according to societal norms, just as the common law can evolve.
On RN, this is God Forbid. I'm James Carlton with my co-presenter, Breanne Fallon. We're speaking with Professor Sarah Joseph of the Law School at Griffith University and Professor George Williams from UNSW. Much more ahead.
Australia has a patchwork of domestic and international mechanisms that promote the maintenance of human rights, but we lack a clear codifying human rights document. Could a Bill of Rights be a possible solution to this issue?
Well, we have Canada, as we've heard, United States, South Africa all have Bills of Rights in their constitutions, and the United Kingdom and New Zealand have Human Rights Acts, statutory. Many other countries also have bills or charters of human rights. Brazil, India, Hong Kong, Kazakhstan, Iraq, East Timor, Turkey, Argentina. Yet Australia does not. So where does this leave us on the international stage?
Former Australian Foreign Minister Gareth Evans has gone as far to say that it has tarnished our reputation as a good international citizen. He spoke to ABC's Paul Barclay last month for Big Ideas.
Every time we've ever started getting the argument going, it's met extraordinary resistance from all sorts of people that you might have thought would be a little bit more balanced. I mean, the churches have constantly said this is dangerous rather than a source of attraction to them. I'm not talking about rights as a sword, but as a shield against discrimination. And, you know, it was a fierce rearguard resistance. support from some of my political colleagues. I mean, Bob Carr has been a fierce opponent for decades because he said the very definition of a Bill of Rights is you have these things being determined by judges. That's an abdication of political responsibility.
That's the line.
Well, it's not necessarily an absolute abdication. If you make it constitutional and unamendable effectively, then there can be problems if the judges get it wrong. But if you make a legislative Bill of Rights, like the Canadian one, the New Zealand one, like the state ones that exist all around the country here at the moment, you can cope with patterns of decision-making that, you know, are wildly astray. We've seen the whole problem with the religious discrimination bill, the inability to have, you know, clear-headed, rational arguments about these things. It's just been gone into the too hard basket. But it does make us very distinctive in international circuit. We're about the only country in the world, the only rich, developed country that doesn't have formal protections of individual rights. Every other country does.
Former Australian Minister Gareth Evans speaking to Big Ideas presenter Paul Barclay last month. We'll put a link up to their full conversation on our website. Now, Professor George Williams, you were previously a Labor pre-selection candidate for the ACT. Why do you think there's so much reluctance for a Bill of Rights in Australia when it's having such an impact on us on the international stage?
I must admit that was well over a decade ago. But I actually don't think there is much reluctance in Australia when it comes to the community level. The polls over many years have demonstrated support at least 60%, sometimes as high as 80%. And the most recent polls have shown a surge in support during the pandemic to well over 80% in one poll. That's because I think Australians during the pandemic have recognised they have been quite vulnerable to the use of extraordinary government power, and perhaps justified to protect our right to life, but it's opened their eyes in many cases to just how significant an amount of power our politicians can exercise, and they've asked what sort of checks and balances are there to make sure that that's tempered, and have found, in fact, those checks and balances aren't there to the extent that they would like.
So, Sarah Joseph, if we did have a Bill of Rights in Australia, a federal one, and it had been implemented before the virus came, how would the last few years have been different to what they were?
That's a very, very difficult question to answer because, again, it would perhaps depend on the type of Bill of Rights. I actually suspect that the most likely Bill of Rights we are to get would, again, be the one that was recommended by the Brennan Inquiry, which would therefore only apply to the federal government. Now, a lot of the measures, of course, were taken by state governments. So if we had a federal Bill of Rights that did not apply to state bodies, then it wouldn't have done a lot about, you know, for example, lockdowns in Melbourne and across the country. But it would have been something which constrains the federal government and would have perhaps provided at least an avenue of potential remedy for the so-called stranded Australians, those who were locked out of the country for, you know, many months and in many cases, you know, the whole 2 years.
Well, then let's turn to Victoria, where there is a state Bill of Rights. In fact, our guest George Williams contributed to its drafting. What did that achieve, if anything, during the harsh lockdowns we saw in Victoria, the area where this Bill of Rights has jurisdiction?
Yeah, and then the important thing to recognise when we're in a pandemic is that harsh restrictions cut both ways, that they very clearly are a restriction upon human rights, our ability to leave home, our ability to move, to associate. But also these measures are protective of human rights, in particular the right to life. And so harsh measures by itself are not problematic if they're undertaken in a proportionate way that's actually designed to protect human rights with the minimal impact upon other rights. Where the Victorian Charter helped is it provided a yardstick to assess what was appropriate, how far should government go. So the Chief Medical Officer, for example, referenced the Charter of Rights in looking at when the curfew needed to be closed down. It also meant that agencies could assess government. So the Ombudsman, for example, could examine whether government had crossed the line. And in some key areas, it was found the government did. It went too far. It overreacted in seeking to protect the community. So what the Charter did is it provided a yardstick at a point of emergency to help guide decision-making. And I actually think in the midst of a pandemic, it's especially important that you have an instrument like this to remind governments of their responsibilities, while at the same time saying we need to vest them with, you know, quite extraordinary power. They need to be able to act quickly, to take tough measures to protect the community, but within the context of a human rights framework.
But doesn't it run the risk of limiting rights, because the very fact of defining and codifying rights means that we are expressing where they are limited, where they stop. And the Victorian human rights framework was developed before the pandemic. We couldn't foresee what was to happen, yet we had this rigid and fixed document.
Well, and it is a fixed only in the sense that it lists the rights that are protected, some 20 rights, but they're expressed in general terms that can be applied to whatever circumstances emerge. So if you take the right to freedom of speech, to protest, of course, that will apply differently in the midst of a pandemic when there's other circumstances such as the possibility of public infection that come into play than in other times. So it doesn't give you direct answers. It provides a tool, a framework to make sure you bring to play all of the key considerations around human rights. It can be applied flexibly according to the need at the time. And it means that when you make those big decisions, things like free speech, freedom of religion, right to life, ought to be front and centre of government decision-making in a way that otherwise they may not be.
So I'm hearing from you that these sorts of documents are a yardstick, they're a framework, they give us some sort of measure. Well, Australia is already signatory to multiple human rights treaties, and we've received hundreds of recommendations from the Universal Periodic Review to the UN. What are we being asked to address? What are we not doing well in the rights arena?
Yeah, it's a well-put question, because we do, of course, have those yardsticks internationally. They've been in place for decades, but the bottom line is that they are firstly not enforceable in Australia, so they don't give rise to remedies, and secondly, they often lack legitimacy. In fact, our governments on a number of occasions have indicated a strong desire to act contrary to the international standards. They've said they're not Australian standards. So they lack the political backing, the political clout to actually be effective. And that's why you need a domestic standard. It's why the United Kingdom, for example, had its Domestic Human Rights Act, as opposed to just relying upon European standards, because it was felt that local politics needs, in our case, Australian-based standards that have legitimacy, buy-in, recognition in a way that international standards are incapable of doing.
What about the international stage where Australia sits? Because, you know, you can argue that Turkey and Iraq are ahead of us because they have bills of rights, which you argue for, and we don't. But it's absurd to say that human rights receive more protection in Turkey than in Australia. So the presence or absence of a Bill of Rights, at least in this example, is not a determining factor.
No, it's only one factor, I agree. And no one could suggest that a Bill of Rights by itself would make a difference in changing our society. It's just one piece of that puzzle. And in fact, you can look at even a quite authoritarian countries like Stalin's USSR, which had a Bill of Rights, but it was just a show document. It had no meaningful impact. A Bill of Rights matters when you have a supporting community, a political culture, systems that enable accountability, courts, for example, to hold people to account and to make sure that people act fairly. When you have those things, an instrument which says these are our rights, these must be respected and here are remedies, it bites and it has impact. But it is critical that you actually have that supporting political culture. And I would even go so far as to say that very often the supporting political culture is much more important than the Bill of Rights. Those decisions that our leaders make, the leadership they show, that can often be of more impact than any legal instrument can be by itself.
So, Sarah, is a Bill of Rights as much about laying out this foundation as it is about holding our government to account?
Yeah, I would say that. And I would add to what George was saying that, you know, a Bill of Rights is clearly part of the puzzle. It's not the be-all and end-all, because I think it would be wrong to say that Australia has a much worse human rights record than certain countries which have Bills of Rights, and you've named Iraq and Turkey. Another thing I'd say which is important is Australia does have a commitment to the rule of law, and therefore if we had a Bill of Rights and decisions, you know, were made by courts to say that, you know, Australia was breaching human rights, the government might whinge about it, and in fact sometimes it does whinge about court cases, but it does in fact ultimately abide by the rule of law, and so that's important.
But doesn't this involve the transfer of more power to judges, the transfer of more wealth, to speak frankly, to lawyers, and a diminution of the power of the parliament, which is elected, re-elected and re-elected again, the basis of our Westminster system?
Yeah, I mean, there is this argument, and it's the Bob Carr type argument, that a Bill of Rights passes power to unelected judges. Look, I think that this point about unelected judges is overblown. I mean, for a start, we certainly don't want elected judges. I think that would be a disaster for the rule of law in this country. That implies that judges are unaccountable. Judges are accountable, but in a different way. They have to issue reasoned judgments after open court proceedings, and often they are subject to appeal. And unless the Bill of Rights is actually a constitutional Bill of Rights, it can, in fact, a judgment can be overturned or amended by subsequent legislation, which is up to the Parliament whether it wants to pass it or not. So I don't really buy this argument that it passes all sorts of powers to unelected judges. Judges in this country already make very powerful decisions. I mean, you can go back to the ban on the Communist Party, or even much more recently, work choices, or even the challenge to the West Australian border by Clive Palmer. I mean, all of these are issues which judges ultimately had to decide. I don't see what is so special about human rights issues that we have to keep them away from judges. Judges are also naturally apolitical, and so are much more likely, I think, to be able to come up with decisions which actually protect minorities as opposed to majoritarian parliaments. And that's not necessarily because parliaments want to persecute minorities. It may be that they just are not paying enough attention to minorities for very obvious political reasons.
We're with Professor Sarah Joseph and Professor George Williams on God Forbid. You can subscribe to the God Forbid podcast on iTunes or the ABC radio app. Up next, what role does a Bill of Rights have in other pieces of legislation?
The Australian Human Rights Commission states that Australia has a strong and proud record on human rights, but that record is not perfect. Some groups are particularly vulnerable to human rights abuses, including Indigenous people, people with disability, asylum seekers, and those living in poverty.
The recent religious discrimination bill that was ultimately pulled for now highlights the potential difficulties Australia might face in ensuring equality for everyone. Let's hear from Renee Barker, a religion and law expert at the University of Western Australia. She spoke with RN's Andrew West on the tension that exists at the heart of the religious discrimination bill.
The tension at the heart of this is a question of what is the place for religion in the public space. So one of the challenges with religion is that it encompasses almost all aspects of a person's life, what they do, what they say, how they act, what they wear, what they eat. Almost anything can potentially be impacted by their religious beliefs and practices. And the challenge here is that for some people, what other people do in the name of their religion or say or believe in the name of their religion may be offensive, distressing, or simply incredulous. And so when people want to carry out those religious beliefs and practices in the public sphere, so in their employment, in their education, when they're doing things out in the public sphere, that can cause other people distress because it is maybe offensive to them, it may be challenging, something they've not seen before, something they find really uncomfortable. And this debate, this bill is really about where do we draw those lines? Where do we say, no, that particular religious behaviour or practice is not acceptable for a variety of reasons, or say to people who are feeling uncomfortable or distressed or offended, no, I'm sorry, but freedom of religion means this person is allowed to practice their faith in the public sphere, and your distress, your uncomfortableness has to be borne by you. We're not going to prohibit that religious behaviour. So that's the tension. Where do we draw that line?
Dr. Renee Barker speaking with RN's Andrew West on the Religion and Ethics Report. We'll put a link to their full conversation on the God Forbid website. Well, George Williams, where is the line that Renee Barker spoke of? Where's it drawn at the moment? Because the Religious Discrimination Bill has not been passed by Scott Morrison's government. Does this mean in some circumstances and jurisdictions there is inadequate protection of religious freedom?
Well, yes. And as someone who is a supporter of better human rights protection, I think one place to look at carefully is religious freedom. We do have a mention of religious freedom in the Australian Constitution, but it's weak and ineffective. At the state level, there is no such protection. So it's quite possible for a state parliament to pass a law banning certain forms of religious dress, banning religious worship. There's quite a long list of things that a state could do if it wants to. And I think it's a clear area where people of faith are reasonable to expect that the law would do more to protect them in their basic religious exercise and belief.
And peculiar mismatches abound. Like in South Australia, it's illegal for you to be discriminated against in the workplace based on religious dress, but not religious anything else.
Yes, and there's many inconsistencies, that's right. And it's what happens when you have this patchwork of protection and non-protection across the country. You end up with some very odd outcomes. And in Australia, when we look at this particular right, it's either absent or where protected, it's done so often in odd and confusing ways. And I think the problem with the religious discrimination bill we had was, even though it was tackling a problem, we do need to improve in this area, it actually didn't do so in a very effective way, and it didn't do so as part of a broader comprehensive package. Because what we need is not just better protecting religious freedom, but also freedom of speech and the many other rights that, like religious freedom, don't get adequate protection at the moment.
So, Sarah Joseph, if anything was an advertisement for the need for a federal Bill of Rights, the Religious Discrimination Bill is probably a good example. Plus, if we think about current debates around LGBTQIA plus rights, like these discussions around transgender women in sport, it's evident that there are numerous human rights issues that potentially would be impacted enormously by a bill of this kind. What role would a Bill of Rights have in future legislation like the Religious Discrimination Bill? Would it just not exist? Would it be taken off the table altogether?
I think one problem with the latest iteration, and in fact most iterations of this Religious Discrimination Bill, is that it sort of placed freedom of religion above other rights, because one thing about human rights is that one person's right can conflict with another person's human right. And in that instance, you do need a decision maker, and under a Bill of Rights, it would be a judge or, you know, some sort of court to decide which right prevails in a certain instance. The way that the Religious Discrimination Bill was written was to sort of put religion, which is currently in a fairly poor position when it comes to protection, was to raise it above, you know, kind of other statuses. Whereas a Bill of Rights would allow decision makers to balance rights appropriately.
What about the other argument one hears, Sarah Joseph, that the more you codify rights, the more rights you put into the code or the Bill of Rights, the more opportunities there are for, you know, unmeritorious, vexatious claims which really do nothing apart from clog up already clogged courts and leave people who haven't abused human rights in the difficult position of having to pay for their defence or, you know, having to get themselves out of legal trouble?
Well, I just don't think we've seen that in this country. I think that that's a bit of a stereotype.
But we don't have a Bill of Rights. Maybe we will see it if we do.
Well, we haven't seen it in Victoria and Queensland and the ACT. Where we do see it is in the United States, which is an extraordinarily litigious society. So I think that's a bit of a stereotype. It's kind of the old lawyer's picnic argument. And, you know, we do have ways of dealing with vexatious litigants.
So before we get to the courts, I mean, we don't have a Bill of Rights. We're supposed to have this process of human rights parliamentary scrutiny. Is this actually functioning well, Professor Williams?
Well, we do have a process that was brought in instead of us getting this Bill of Rights about a decade ago. And the idea is that when Parliament makes laws, it should look at the long list of human rights in international conventions and make a wise decision in light of those. But it just has not proved to be effective. I think it's partly that those international rights don't have the sort of support that's needed within the federal parliament for them to be taken seriously. Another problem is that parliamentarians often just aren't interested in sticking with them. And indeed, that the whole point of a Bill of Rights is to actually provide a check and balance against political power. And in this case, a scrutiny mechanism simply is an advisory tool that they can ignore at will. So the system we have, this scrutiny regime, it sometimes elevates the issue a little, but in terms of actually changing behaviour, in terms of actually protecting vulnerable people, it just hasn't proved to be effective in that regard.
I think the scrutiny regimes in places like Victoria and Queensland, it's probably a little early to judge, but in Victoria and the ACT, probably functions better. And that's because, you know, we have all three arms of government involved, including the judiciary, whereas the federal system, which George was just referring to, is simply executive and legislative. There's no role for the courts.
On RN, it is God Forbid. We are with George Williams, Sarah Joseph, and my co-presenter, Breanne Fallon.
Australia received recommendations from the UN on how to improve its human rights standings. Amongst those recommendations is improvement in the treatment of Australia's Indigenous population. Current policymaking does not have a systematic process for Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to provide advice, meaning that policy is often made for them rather than with them or by them. A Voice to Parliament is a proposed body to be enshrined in the Constitution that would enable Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander peoples to provide advice to the Parliament on policies and projects that impact their lives.
Here's Professor Megan Davis, Pro Vice-Chancellor Indigenous at the University of New South Wales, where she's also Professor of Law, and she's speaking with Richard Feidler.
The fact is that the basis of settlement in Australia is and always was the exertion of force by and on behalf of the British Crown. But the reality is that no one asked permission to settle and no one consented and no one ceded. And so the legal status in terms of Australia today is that sovereignty wasn't passed from the Aboriginal peoples. And the High Court didn't satisfactorily deal with that in Mabo. And so today we still live with the consequences of the nation not grappling with that original grievance.
One of the reasons why the situation with Aboriginal people is not mentioned in the Constitution is because it seems that Aboriginal people could just be sort of put to one side as a dying race at the time. You've got a quote there from Alfred Deakin, and I'm going to quote this. Alfred Deakin, one of our founding fathers, the man, there's a university and an electorate named after him. Alfred Deakin said this at Federation. It says 120 years ago he said this. He's looking backwards and he's looking forwards as he's saying this. Deakin said, little more than 100 years ago, Australia was a dark continent in every sense of the term. There was not a white man within its borders. In another century, he predicted, the probability is that Australia will be a white continent with not a black or even dark skin amongst its inhabitants. The Aboriginal race has died out in the south, he said, and is dying fast in the north and west, even when we're most gently treated. Other races are to be excluded by legislation if they are tinted to any degree. My God, Megan, when I read that, it's passive rather than active language, but it's like the correspondence that was being made amongst senior Nazis during the Second World War. What did you think when you read that from Alfred Deakin?
Yeah, no. I mean, I think a lot of Australians, and at least our law students, are shocked when they read just the way in which race and racism and white superiority, white supremacy has imbued Australia's constitutional system. And I think more Australians' understanding about that kind of thinking around Aboriginal people and how that's imbued the constitution is really critical, I think, in terms of the reforms that we're trying to set up. Because, you know, we don't receive much opposition to the voice that we're fighting for, because it is to some degree, a very functional, practical reform. But part of it is about saying, look, we were excluded from the drafting of the Constitution, and we were excluded from the Constitution, except to exclude us expressly. And it's not okay to say in this day and age, well, you know, it's a violation of fairness and the rule of law and equality to have Aboriginal people have a voice in this Constitution. You wouldn't say that if you really deeply understood the way in which we were regarded in terms of how Aboriginal people and race is allied to the nation's institutions and rules. You know, what it does is it compels the Commonwealth to have our people at the table when they have these conversations about our lives. And the point here, Richard, about why it's so critical is that at the moment there are very few Aboriginal and Torres Strait Islander people at the table when laws and policies are made. And I think all Australians can see from the disadvantage and the failure of the Closing the Gap framework that manifests in really poor laws and policies, because you're just not asking the right people. You know, this is the 60,000-year-old ancient polity seeking to be recognised in the nation state that was formed on our country. Our ancient jurisdictions, our ancient polities are now, you know, stepping up to the Australian people and saying, recognise us, recognise our voice in the Constitution, and that we can get to a place of shared identity a nation that has some sense of shared belonging. This is what the Uluru Statement is trying to do. It is trying to unite the nation.
Professor Megan Davis, Pro Vice Chancellor Indigenous at the University of New South Wales and Professor of Law there too, speaking with ABC's Richard Feidler. We'll put a link to their full conversation on the God Forbid website.
Hearing from Professor Davis there, it's very clear that there is a lack of inclusion and conversation in the current human rights and legislative discussions. What potential impact would a voice to Parliament have for the rights of Indigenous Australians, Sarah?
Well, it would ensure that Indigenous voices were heard when policies were being constructed for them. And so you wouldn't get things like the Northern Territory intervention created the way it was in a rush without, you know, serious consultation with the people it was going to affect. You would also get the Indigenous voice in coming up with proposals to close the gap. I mean, every government, every political party wants to close the gap, but it appears not to be working. And so maybe having an enshrined Indigenous voice to have Australia's First Peoples finally constitutionally guaranteed to be heard.
What about the argument, Sarah Joseph, A, that this constitutional amendment may fail and that will bring its own problems in terms of the ambition to create reconciliation in this country, or indeed if it succeeds, it'll be two parliaments for two peoples?
Well, I might take the second issue first. It's not two parliaments for two peoples. It has been described in the past as some sort of, you know, extra legislative body, which is simply wrong. It's not a right of veto, it's a right of consultation. And it's a right of consultation over laws which affect Indigenous people. So I don't see it as two separate parliaments. It's in fact making sure that the Indigenous voice is heard within the one federal parliament. It is true what you say about constitutional referendums. There is a political danger that a referendum would fail, but that's where we need real leadership on the part of, you know, the government, whoever should win the next election, and also the opposition. You know, we will never amend our constitution in a way so as to include Indigenous people if we're too afraid to even try.
Professor Williams, as somebody who had such a role in human rights in Victoria, I'm wondering if we're seeing a better inclusion of the Indigenous voice at that state level.
We are seeing, yes, a lot of change at the state level. In fact, we're seeing more change at the state level than we are nationally, even though the focus of people like Megan Davis is upon a national voice. So you can look at Victoria. That's a good place to start, where a treaty process has begun. An elected assembly of Indigenous peoples is playing a key role in that. And that follows from the recognition of cultural rights within the Victorian Charter. Another place that is leading the debate is Queensland. Again, an institution that has its own Human Rights Act. So I think it shows that if you have a charter, it can actually act as quite a powerful catalyst in having people think differently about how the community is engaged. It can open up space for new conversations and can highlight injustices that may have been there for many, many decades, but with a charter or a Bill of Rights, they become more prominent and I think harder to ignore.
And Sarah Joseph, if we did implement a federal Bill of Rights, wouldn't that override the state's Bills of Rights, which George Williams has just been speaking glowingly of?
Well, it could happen. It is possible that the federal parliament could. I mean, the federal parliament does have the constitutional power to enact a statute which comprehensively protects human rights, and under the external affairs power, it could enact that, and it could say, look, this binds all of the states as well. So the Commonwealth Parliament could choose to do that. I think that's unlikely. I think it's more likely that they would do what they've done in the discrimination field, which is, you know, allow room for, say, a federal race discrimination act, but also state race discrimination acts. By the way, that was something they weren't going to allow with the religious discrimination bill. So that was another thing that was unusual about that bill. I also think the most likely federal statute would actually apply to federal government bodies and would not be drafted so as to bind the states. And so I think that it's more likely that we'd get a complementary statute rather than one which would override. It's certainly constitutionally possible that we could get one that overrides all the other human rights acts, but I just don't think that's likely.
So is the answer to throw out the state acts and go with a federal one, or should we continue going state by state? I mean, we've already had three, or is it a mix of both, Professor Williams?
I think it's a mix of both. I actually think that there's room for diversity here. As we have seen with anti-discrimination, you can find one jurisdiction has a good model, jumps ahead of the others, others follow when they find it actually works effectively. So with Victoria, for example, it started with a good model, but Queensland improved on it. And I think when we do get the national model, it'll be better again. I also think as a matter of principle, it's actually a good idea to have a Human Rights Act, a Bill of Rights, wherever a parliament exercises power on behalf of the people. And so in a federal system like Australia, as you find in the United States, Canada and the like, it's a good idea to have these instruments for each parliament. And that means that each community has the rights in place and make sure that they're subject to checks and balances.
So, Professor Sarah Joseph, is a Bill of Rights at a federal level truly the answer?
Oh, well, it's an answer. I think it would definitely improve human rights protection in Australia. And from my point of view, that would be an excellent outcome. So it's an answer. But, you know, as we've discussed before, it's not the answer. We do have countries in the world which have terrible human rights records, which have bills of rights on paper. So, you know, we know that bills of rights have to be supplemented, in many cases in Australia, supplemented by things we already have, such as respect for the rule of law and so on. So I think it would be a major improvement in governance in this country. Whether it's the answer, no. I mean, if we get a Bill of Rights, will I be satisfied and think that there's no improvements to governance that can be made? No, probably not. There's probably always room for improvement.
And last word on this to you, George Williams. Perhaps you might want to mention the right to freedom of speech, something that a lot of us in Australia think is far more protected than it really is.
Well, when Australians have been asked how well protected their rights are, polls have consistently shown that they already think we have a Bill of Rights. The poll last year that showed about 60% of Australians think we have a national Bill of Rights. 10 years ago, the figure was about the same. But Australians, by and large, think their rights are well protected. It's only when they actually look a bit deeper they realise it's not the case. And that's why the pandemic has been so significant, because for many people, it's opened their eyes and the sort of assumptions they have about freedom of speech and other rights have just not been borne out. And as a result, many more Australians are saying we need this change.
Well, we're moving to the Wits End quiz next, where the rubber meets the road on RN, God forbid. Breanne Fallon is your presenter, along with me, James Carlton. Here's Wits End.
Wits End!
Yes, it's at Wits End, the God forbid quiz, and a rights edition thereof. As always, we begin with the buzzers. Now, Professor George Williams' buzzer, does he agree with Rick Mail from The Young Ones about property rights? Here's the buzzer.
Property is theft, Vivian.
There we go. All property is theft, Vivian.
And Professor Sarah Joseph, this is what she's told every time she tells the Australian Parliament that we need a Bill of Rights.
Can I take that one as a comment?
I didn't know Tony Jones was an MP. Anyway, first question. The Magna Carta, a royal charter of rights agreed by King John of England at Runnymede near Windsor, 15th of June 1215. Not the time, the year. How many words are in the Magna Carta? 3,550, 13,550, or 30,550?
All property is theft, Vivian.
3,550.
Well, I agree with George, the 3,001, yeah.
Well, you're both right. You're both right. Does Australia have a copy that you know of?
No.
I think there's an imitation, a replica at the Old Parliament House Museum of Democracy. Next question. Allegra Spender is the independent candidate in Malcolm Turnbull's former electorate, the once Blue Ribbon Harbourside Division of Wentworth in Sydney's East. She's in with a chance, according to the polls, of knocking off the Liberal incumbent, David Sharma. Now, Allegra Spender is daughter of the late fashion designer Carla Zampatti. But who is her father and what role did he historically play in the Australian Bill of Rights debate?
Oh, that's a fascinating question, but I don't know the answer.
Allegra Spender's dad.
All property is theft, Vivian.
Was it Percy Spender?
That's granddad. John Spender's in the middle, the father.
Well, there you go. I went back too far. And no, I don't know the role in the Bill of Rights debate, though.
Well, when the Hawke Labor government was trying to implement a Bill of Rights in 86, he was Liberal Shadow Attorney General, who successfully argued against the proposed bill, saying it adds nothing to our rights. It grossly erodes them by setting up a commission with powers more apt for a police state. Is that how you remember the bill?
That would make sense.
Because you agree with him?
Oh, no, because that's, I remember what was said at the time. So, yeah, okay, if he was Shadow Attorney General, that would make sense that that's what was said at the time.
Well, let's head over the seas now for the next question. On what date does the US celebrate Bill of Rights Day, and why does it fall on that day?
Can I take that one as a comment?
Okay, it's not the 4th of July.
I didn't even know they had a Bill of Rights Day, and I have lived in the US for a while, so I missed that one.
Well, there you go.
I mean, I presume it's the day they adopted the Bill of Rights.
Yeah, we pay that as correct. 15th of December, the anniversary of the new United States of America ratifying the Bill of Rights, the first 10 amendments to the US Constitution. 1791 was the year.
Well, there's a new public holiday for you both, the 15th of December.
Excellent.
Well, rostered day off, more likely.
What was the latest country to implement a Bill of Rights?
Oh.
Give you a clue. It's in Africa.
Can I take that one as a comment?
Is it South Sudan?
No.
We'll give you another clue. It was in 2013.
And it has a checkered record.
Is it Zimbabwe?
Yes.
Zimbabwe. Ooh. With Sarah. Well done.
There you go.
So which of the following organisations, this is the final question which will determine the outcome, not of just the quiz, but the entire rights debate in this country for generations. Which of the following organisations has a Bill of Rights? The Country Women's Association, the New York State Brewers Association, or the UK Specialist Cheesemakers Association?
Can I take that one as a comment?
I'm going with the Country Women's.
Oh, Country Women's. You're worried about those scones, aren't you?
There's a human right to scones for sure.
Where you often find people in rural areas are actually much more supportive of this stuff than those in cities.
Why might that be?
I think because they more obviously see injustice, not having a level playing field.
Not being heard.
Yeah, that's right. They want a system that, yeah, hears them more.
Well, while I love the logic behind that answer, it's actually the New York State Brewers Association.
There you go.
Well, with that, we have reached a most informative end of the God Forbid program, with thanks to our wonderful guests, Sarah and George, and to our wonderful co-host, Breanne Fallon.
Thank you very much, James. It's been a wonderful 2 weeks with you. Thank you for having me for two human rights themes episode of God Forbid.
Well, I want you to come back again in the future very much indeed. And to Sarah Joseph, thank you for being on the show as well.
Well, thank you for having me.
Sarah's Professor of Human Rights Law at Griffith University. For 15 years, she was the director of the Kastan Centre for Human Rights Law. She trains and educates in human rights all around the world.
And thank you very much to George Williams.
Thank you.
George Williams is Deputy Vice Chancellor and Professor of Law at UNSW. In 2005, as Chair of the Victorian Human Rights Consultation Committee, he helped bring about Australia's first state bill of human rights.
Don't forget you can subscribe to the God Forbid podcast on the ABC Listen app or listen on the wireless even. Email us at godforbid@abc.net.au. I'm James Carlton with Breanne Fallon. Until next week, remember to be good. This has been God Forbid.
Listening to an ABC podcast. Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.